You know, that I think it was Wednesday we went out.
Right.
Yeah, Wednesday morning we walk in there. And, you know, there's all this activity and all these people kind of, you know, working together, talking to each other. It's kind of like we were there, but we weren't there.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, wow, you know, these people are doing all this just with this tiny staff and this really small space. I mean, what was your kind of first impression when you walked in that morning?
Well, when I got there, there was only one person there. That was Marshall, who's the director of advocacy. And he was standing outside, and he was telling me about how something had broken the night before, and he had to dig under the house in the crawl space to fix something. And he was showing me his dirty clothes and showing me the garden he planted in the back. And, you know, then we went inside, and they kind of gave me a tour. And, you know, as clients started to arrive, I started to get a sense of things. And, you know, I had to kind of adjust my comfort level a little bit, you know.
What do you mean?
Well, you know, I think, I mean, it's definitely not an environment that I'm used to being in. So I had to make sure that I was more focused on the story I was there to get than on my own emotional reaction or to what I was, you know, to the people or to the place or to their mission or just, you know, there was so many things going on that I was kind of being exposed to all at once, you know, and just kind of trying to take it all in but not be overwhelmed by it. It was an initial challenge, you know.
I was overwhelmed. Yeah. I didn't even realize how overwhelmed I was until we left that day.
Mm. Yeah.
What was it like for you?
Well, hey, like you say, it's impossible not to be overwhelmed, especially once we went out with the mobile unit, you know, and we started to meet the people. And, you know, I mean, it was such an interesting experience because, you know, you kind of have in your mind what you expect, you know, whether you've seen it on TV or whatnot, you know, in terms of addicts or even recovering addicts or what have you. And I mean, they ran the gamut, you know. I mean, there were people who were, I mean, just about everybody defied stereotype in some kind of way for me, you know. Like, we met the guy who was a former radio broadcaster.
Doc.
Yeah, Doc, you know, who now hops trains between Chicago and Atlanta. And, you know, everybody had just a really interesting story like that. And they were so open with telling their story that, you know, was kind of incredible to me. You know, I imagine if I was in a situation like that, I might be less hesitant, but I don't know, or more hesitant, I'm not sure, but... the thing I guess I walked away with is just the humanity. You know, there was still a sense of humanity in everybody, despite, you know, what condition they might be in. So that was pretty pretty interesting.
I wondered the whole time we were there if the only reason that we were getting that access and people were so comfortable was because of the long-standing and great work that the Harm Reduction Coalition does in that area. I mean, these people really trusted these workers and volunteers.
Exactly. Yeah, no, you're right about that. I mean, I agree. And I definitely think it was because of that. You know, I think they made that point at one time. Verna Gaines, who is the outreach coordinator, I think she made that point that they're so they were willing to be so open with us because they are so trusting of AHRQ. And, you know, there were still certain people who didn't want to talk or,
sure,
or didn't want to have their photos taken, and totally respected that, you know. But just to be there and take it all in regardless was still, like I said, quite an experience, you know.
I've been to the Bluff for another story.
Okay.
Familiar with it, kind of mm-hmm. knew what happens, what right. goes on. But to be there at the corner there where everything takes place and mm-hmm. just see it, you know, for hours on end,
mm-hmm.
it it got to me in the sense that I imagine how few people know really what's going on here. Like, take the time to even care. And, you know, kind of a personal aside, that was really frustrating to me. You know, when you're down there taking all this in and you're seeing things you've never seen before, what was your reaction?
I mean, you know, that's what's so funny about Atlanta to me. Stuff can be hidden in pockets, and you can be so close to it that unless you've been down there, you would never know it existed, you know. We have these areas in Atlanta where as soon as you cross a certain street, reality changes. The whole landscape changes. You know, Northside Drive is like that street that separates the Bluff from, you know, Georgia Tech. You know what I mean? And I think that's always kind of interesting to me, especially right now as Atlanta is really changing and, you know, the demographics of the city, the inner city are changing, and you still have these pockets like the Bluff that exist and have existed for a long time, but they're like butting up against change right now, you know. And in a lot of ways, they're still hidden. And, you know, you kind of wonder what's going to become of them as these changing forces, like, start to move closer in, you know. And I mean, I got to talk to the city councilman who represents that area, Ivory Young, and he talked about development, you know, redevelopment that they want to do and revitalization, and how he feels like AHARC is kind of holding them back from that, because, you know, he feels like it's kind of the clientele that they attract would, you know, not be something that new homeowners would want to live around. And so, you know, then it becomes this thing of like, okay, well, what's more important, the potential real estate value or the people that live there now? And, you know, it's like you like a place like AHARC because they are trying to serve this population and this community, you know, that exists there now. Whereas a lot of people, I think, are more concerned with getting the people out so that they can do something different with the land. You know, it's right there next to where the stadium is going to be.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you mentioned Councilman Young. I was thinking of state lawmakers, even not from that district, what they would think, how their views would or would not change if they spent a couple of hours like we did. Georgia's anti-paraphernalia law that's been on the books for decades. I think there's a good spirit behind it. I think there's good intent behind it. You know, the state doesn't want people to get hooked on drugs.
Right.
It really punishes some good work that's going on down there. It makes it difficult. And that's a tension that I could never resolve. You know, and still can as I put this story together.
Yeah,
I can't resolve that. Is there something that at kind of the end of the day you said, look, I could spend the rest of my life toiling on this and I won't come to an answer? You know, did you come across that? And if so, what was that moment?
Well, I don't know. I mean, like you say, the issue is, you know, it's hard to be yay or nay. Either way, I think I think definitely spending time down there, hearing people's stories, gave me more insight into the reality of that situation. You know, the lady who drives from Tennessee.
Yeah, Darlene.
Darlene,
sure.
Who once a month she and her husband drive 3.5 hours from Tennessee to exchange needles because this is the closest place where they can do something like that. I think that her story, which, you know, we heard like first thing in the morning, was pretty eye-opening and, like, you know, like you said before, overwhelming.
Yeah.
But to really be able to see that reality up close and understand, at least for her, how few options they have. I mean, she said, she's going to be doing it regardless. She's been doing it for 20 years. Her husband's been doing it for 40 years.
Right.
And they just want to be able to do it safely. It's like, hey, and when you look at a lot of what's going on in other countries around the world, and you realize how far behind we are in terms of that kind of stuff, I mean, that says something, you know. Again, it's still a very gray issue because, you know, you don't want to feel like you're enabling people. But I think that, like I said, the reality is what it is. And, you know, I think you have to be able to remove your own hang-ups and you know, feelings about an issue just to be able to care for people where they are.
Yeah. You know? You know, I heard that phrase so many times. You know, we meet people where they are.
Right.
And this was tough. Even as I've talked to colleagues and friends, and you know, if you were around me the 3 days after mm-hmm. we went down there, you mm-hmm. would know something was not right with me. Okay. I mean, it just stuck with me. So people asked, and you know, I'd tell them what we were doing, and they couldn't get past this drug use. After the fact, I got the sense that just didn't work.
Mm-hmm,
these
mm-hmm.
folks are going to do what they're going to do. And in fact, I think that's what Claude told me. He said, I'm going to do what I'm going to do.
Right.
But there was one client mm-hmm. who shared her recovery story, and okay. she was about to check in. And that's really the moment that shifted for me.
Okay.
When I didn't even think about this whole enable thing, right? They're not just saving lives by giving people clean needles, stopping or slowing the spread of HIV and AIDS. They're helping people get back on track.
Mm.
And I think a lot of that's lost in the stigma of the needle exchange
right.
part.
Yeah, that's a good point.
But, so to have that one positive story when I looked around and thought, wow, these are the stories that I'm seeing today are really negative in so many ways.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people's lives are lost.
Mm-hmm.
Harm reduction, struggling to stay open even though they're doing really kind of good work for the betterment of our community.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think once I got past that wall, I really saw the story. In your writing, how did you get people past that wall? How did you get or try to get readers to understand this isn't just about heroin mm-hmm. users?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if I was successful at that or not, but... I think I definitely wanted to focus on a little bit on how things could be, you know, meaning seeing a lot of the studies that have been done in other countries and how HIV rates have lowered as a result among drug users. I mean, I felt like that was important because the bottom line is it's a public health issue.
Sure.
You know, and we can get caught up in the public policy and the politics of it, you know, just trying to decide whether it's right or wrong and that kind of stuff, the morality issue of it. But that kind of stuff is not the kind of, I think bottom line, whether you, no matter what side of the issue you stand on with it, you will appreciate the fact that your pockets are affected based on, you know, whether or not these kind of services take place. You know, needle exchange, it does affect your bottom line because if HIV is spreading among this population, we're going to pay for it as taxpayers.
Right.
And I think that's something that even if you feel like drug use is bad and, you know, needle exchange is enabling, you might be willing to pay a little more attention if you realize how it's affecting all of us, you know. I mean, and it's not just from a monetary sense, but for people who are a little, you know, less likely to be open to hearing how it affects us on a human scale.
Sure. So many times I heard that these people were kind of the forgotten ones.
Mm-hmm.
And I got that sense, too, that they knew that not only, you know, are they in a bad situation, and they know they are. I didn't talk to one user who said, you know, I love this. Mm-hmm. This is the life.
Right.
And I am happy with where I am. Not mm-hmm. one person. But all of them said, you know, we're forgotten. It's easy to cast us aside. And I had to think that defeatist kind of sense feeds what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Did you get that sense at all?
Yeah, I mean, you know, they understand, you know, they live that reality. So, you know, I talked to some younger people who were down on the same corner, and they weren't users or addicts, but they had some interesting things to say too, just in terms of how that neighborhood in general is a forgotten place, you know. And these were, I didn't ask their ages, but I imagine if I had to guess, they were in their 20s.
Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah, and they voiced just as much frustration in terms of the reality that they're living in that neighborhood, you know, as some of the other people did. And I think that, you know, and they mentioned the stadium, and they mentioned a lot of the progress that's going on in Atlanta and how they're being left out of that, you know. And they actually found it kind of ironic that, you know, the best kind of social service they could get was something like a needle exchange.
Hmm.
When, you know, they were like, hey, where are parks around here for kids to play and that kind of stuff. So, yeah, it's definitely a forgotten and pushed aside reality, you know.
It was interesting when I would ask people what's the answer. Verna Gaines, the outreach coordinator,
mm-hmm.
really said something that I'd never considered before, and it stuck with me. She said, we as a society need to consider why people start using drugs, why they use it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not that they do, but what societal factors are in play that, you know, people make that choice
mm-hmm.
and fall into addiction. And that's a conversation I've never heard.
Right. Yeah, no. And Mona Bennett, the executive director, said the same thing to me. And again, I think it's, you know, I think the way she kind of put it, it gave me a sense of how much in denial we are as a country.
Sure.
About this issue, you know. And I think a lot of that has to do with how we react when we hear about a needle exchange program, you know. Because I think for the most part, we would like to just be able to sweep all of that stuff under the rug, you know. The same way the bluff is kind of swept under the rug.
I would say that's how we do it in
yeah.
Atlanta, right? That
right.
is the rug that we sweep it under is right there at the bluff.
Right. So, you know, the state of denial is real, and those are conversations that we need to have more, you know. And I think the kind of work that they do acknowledging that kind of forces us to have those kind of conversations.
What, it's been more than two weeks now since we were there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, thinking back today, what sticks with you? What's the one thing that just won't leave your mind?
Well, we went back the next week. I tagged along with Joff Davis, our photographer, because he needed to get some more shots. And kind of like you said, I was just so overwhelmed. I was like, maybe I just need to go back out there to get a better sense of things again. And I met a guy who I got to talk to. He was a client there for the needle exchange. And he was dressed real sharp. He had like a nice derby hat on, a matching denim casual suit, some shiny black shoes, and I got to talking to him, and he was telling me his story. He's been addicted for maybe about 30 years now. He was really clean shaven, had a nice well-kempt beard. He just kind of defied all of the stereotypes, you know. And at the end of the conversation, I can't remember how it came about, but he ended up, I guess I complimented him on how he was dressed. And he said, yeah, just because I'm a junkie, I don't have to dress like one. And again, that kind of struck me because it kind of reinforced the idea that, you know, all of these people are humans, you know, first and foremost. And it makes it hard to judge if you can allow yourself to get in touch with that, you know, the humanity of what's going on. I think it makes it a lot harder to get stuck on the stigma.
Yeah.
And that kind of thing. So, I mean, that's actually the main thing that kind of stuck with me. I mean, because I could very easily see myself in him, you know, and suddenly that reality didn't seem so distant and so far away.
Rodney Carmichael of Creative Loafing, it was a real pleasure to work with you on this.
Yeah, you too, man. I appreciated you being there because you asked some really tough questions that in some situations I didn't have the nerve to ask. So I think that that definitely helped.
All right. Well, again, thanks for coming in. And yeah, hopefully we'll get the chance to work on something else soon.
Yeah, no doubt. Thanks a lot, man.